Let me first acknowledge the people who have really done this work and contributed to this work tremendously. I'm sure I'm not going to do justice to them throughout the rest of my talk. So one of our graduate students, Yu Feng, who's here at the conference, so you're welcome to ask him a lot of questions about this. I'm going to be presenting some work that we've it's still kind of in progress, but we've done with Johan, you heard from this morning. I'm going to present some few extra things from things that he's been doing. Also, Colin de Graaf, a graduate student, has recently graduated, has moved on to work with Avishai in Jerusalem, Nishikanta Kandai, Rupert Croft, Orca Springer, also people at Oxford, Steve Wilkins in Sussex now, and other new graduate students that have come on into this project. So very briefly, what am I trying to tell you about is what can we learn about black holes from cosmological structure formation. So what I want to say a little bit about to start with is why do we even bother doing this at these very large scales? And now how do we actually attempt to do it? And there are some of the very basic things, depending on time as well, that we can start learning from doing this game. So I'm going to mostly focus on some relatively new simulation. One is very new. So these are large cosmological volumes that we've done. We call them not very interesting name, Massive Black, Massive Black 2. But I also touch on some zoom simulations, simulations that from which we're actually trying to go at much higher resolution inside these large boxes. So these are some of the first zooms that actually are done directly from SPH, hydrodynamics, initial condition of larger volumes. Why? I think this has been discussed sufficiently at the conference and elsewhere. We know that the formation, the assembly history, and impact of supermassive black holes is one of our main unsolved problems in cosmic structure formation. There are, and we've already discussed many of these questions, there are probably more within the context of galaxy formation where black holes are likely to play a major role. We'd like to learn about the emergence from the dark ages. We know that black holes are probably going to emerge from the first stars, the collapse of the first halos. What is the impact in the AGM heating, X-ray heating, the impact in reionization itself? So black holes entering that question. We want to know about galaxy mergers, the evolution of colors of galaxies. And again, black holes are likely to play a role in there that we'd like to understand a bit better. More so recently, we're really entering a phase where we are starting to worry about black holes in real cosmology, per se. We want to, for instance, make constraints on cosmological parameters, okay? So the upcoming weak Langsys surveys, such that will be carried out with LSST, Euclid, huge mission, will strongly rely on measuring the equation of state for dark energy at the 1% level. We strongly rely on measurements of the matter power spectrum, particularly at this sort of scales, sort of around 5 megaparsec or so. But in order to make these measures, we need absolute exquisite calibration from simulations, right? We need to be as good as at 1% level. So if you take this sort of straight line as the straightforward prediction from dark matter, we know that baryons are going to have a large effect at some scales over there, but it's been recently pointed out that the dark matter power spectrum that we get in fluctuations is going to be strongly affected at the exact scales that we care about by things like AGN feedback, and unfortunately we don't know much about that, but we know it's going to be up to a 40% effect, so we can forget about LSST and Euclid if we don't understand how to predict the power spectrum at the 40% level or close to that. Okay, so this is sort of really, we're expanding even further out from black holes being important in galaxies, but now really being important in for us getting cosmological constraints. Or if we sort of flip this around, we could be, you know, brave enough to think that if we actually were getting this a better picture of this, we can actually get constraints on AGN feedback, even from cosmology directly, even from constraints such as that we will be getting with these upcoming surveys. On a sort of similar note, but not quite, so again, why do we bother going into this large volume? Why do we bother doing all this business of trying to do full SP hydrodynamics and so on and so forth? It's just there's a lot of physics beyond dark matter that we need to get a grasp on in order to understand the cosmological evolution of these objects. This is just an example. I'm plotting the black hole mass versus the halo mass in one of these large cosmological volumes, just to an illustration to point out there's a large spread of black hole masses for a given halo mass, right? This is again due to all of these extra physics that we need to capture, take into account, and due to the way structure formation itself takes place, different environments will lead you to different kind of physical situations. So that was a redshift 6 for the sort of the bright quasar type of problem. We still have a range of properties. We still have, you know, and this just gets worse towards the lower redshifts. There's more and more scatter in the properties of black holes, or in terms of their masses, in terms of their luminosity, at all sorts of redshifts. Okay. So again, this is sort of to highlight briefly, you know, if I just randomly pick two extremes in this relation. So say I'm taking my 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, and I want to zoom that. But how do I know which zoom am I picking? Am I picking conditions in my large scale realization that would correspond to something more like that, or something more like that, something that you know, is much more inducive to a very bright quasar phase, or something much lower brightness and much lower black hole mass? So to emphasize that sometimes when we embark in these sort of zoom simulations to try and understand the physics of the gas inflows, we always have to keep in mind that at the back there, there's structure formation that gives us different answers in different places, and these answers can be very different. Okay, so we want to keep some perspective on what statistically the answer should have been or would be like, and do these larger volumes and not just do only dark matter. Of course, this is very tough, right? So perhaps the most appealing aspect of this is that we have initial conditions. If we do cosmology, we know what the initial conditions are. So that's a nice problem for us, right? There's very few problems for which the initial conditions are well specified. Here we do. But then all the rest, it's a complete nightmare, right? So we have to run this very large simulation on very large supercomputers. We need to include gravity. We need to include a range of physics from hydrodynamics to radiated cooling, radiated transfer, black hole growth, star formation, all the feedback associated with that. And that's really where the game is, and why is it tough to do this, is because of the large range of physics, and of course because of the dynamical and mass scales involved in this problem, right? So if we are looking at the scales of a black hole within a galaxy, and we're not even talking about gigaparsec, we already have a dynamic range in spatial scale of 10 to the 10. In a mass dynamic range, that is 10 to the 12, if you want to also do star formation. Okay, so even assuming that we're actually able to do all the physics that we need to do, we will never be able to do this problem. We would probably be able to do it in something like 50 years if we just extrapolate, you know, how computers are growing and the number of cores in large machines are growing. Okay, so this would take just an unreasonable amount of time, and it's just not possible to do it. And of course, we don't know the physics, and we're not able to put the physics in at this level anyway. Okay, so it's an extremely challenging problem. Okay, so sort of having highlighted a few of these issues, let me just go into what do we see in this kind of simulations? What do we learn? And how do concentrate first, perhaps, on some of the earliest black holes? And I won't talk about the seed, the problem at all in here, because in these very large simulations, we really don't offer any constraints. For us, a seed black hole is going to be an initial mass that is placed at a newly forming halo in the simulation. There's nothing interesting that we can do about the seed problem per se. Okay, so what we can learn a little bit more is about how, once we do have a seed somewhere, how is the cosmological gas inflow and the inflow of gas into galaxies regulate its growth. So again, as I said, I'm going to do this from the perspective of cosmological simulation. So I'm going to be looking at fairly large volume. I'm going to try to do it high resolution as possible and with full hydrodynamics, because we want to follow this gas accretion. I'm going to be talking about both some zoom simulation and uniform volume, but I'm going to start from the uniform volumes first. So these are large chunky bits of the universe that we're trying to do. So for the first quasars problem, so to understand how the gas inflows may regulate, say, large phases of editorial accretion or so that we want to look for, we've used a very large simulation in terms of volume, close to the gigaparsec in physical units, with full hydro and full SPH. So, but this is only run to redshift 4.75. Again, this would be kind of an impossible task to run it to redshift zero, given how large it is with 64 billion particles. But I'm going to try and touch upon some properties of black holes and galaxies later on in the cosmic history by using this massive black 2 simulation, for which the volume is relatively small and the resolution is even higher than in terms of spatial resolution. And particularly, we're going to get to redshift zero with that. So this is just one example of some software that you was able to use to do visualizations of simulations. This is actually can be run directly on your internet. So this is the massive black simulations. You can sort of see the very large scale, sort of gigaparsec volume. Then zoom in and look for your favorite objects where you want to find them. And the nice feature about this GigaPan software is that it allows you to interactively look into the simulations and do it directly on the internet without having to upload these images or reprocess them in any way. So Yufeng was able to do that. This is the other simulations in a smaller volume, 100 megaparsec, still the largest volume done at these kind of resolutions, but that goes all the way to redshift zero. This is just an example zooming into the simulation, just the complexity of the hydro in the gas distribution that in large halos that you can see when you start doing these cosmological volumes at high resolution. Okay, so this is as far as our black hole model goes. Okay, so within the context of structure formation, we want to do black holes. We're not going to do any interesting physics in here. We're just going to try and put some subgrid physics that capture sort of the basic features. So I said we're going to be seeding black holes, and that's not going to be an interesting process in this simulation in terms of the physics. What we're going to try and follow is black hole accretion, how much gas actually gets into the central regions of these galaxies that is likely to get into the black hole. There is going to be some black hole feedback. And of course, we're going to follow black holes merging onto each other within the resolution, though, that we have. So not, again, the detailed physics of this problem. So there are a variety of ways that this can be done. In the cosmological context, I think Johan went through some of these major elements before. We fix the seed mass. We take the conditions of the density and the speeds to get a sense of the accretion rate. This accretion rate is capped at the Eddington. And we're going to do some feedback by saying, OK, if I'm liberating this much energy, if I take some fraction of the energy that is liberated by the black hole and I couple this back into my surrounding gas, what do I get as an effect? And I keep doing that. As we've heard this morning as well, we can vary these models and make them perhaps more realistic, therefore more appealing. So for instance, we can think about tidal torques, taking into account angular momentum as the gas is falling in. We can think about coupling the energy in the feedback part by really thinking about the momentum coupling of the photon, so in some subgrid radiated transport kind of ideas. Unfortunately, my view of this, I mean, the way I see this is that we all get the same answer anyway, because we have to parameterize this, because we are in a subgrid regime at these scales. So we are actually, unfortunately, not learning very much of this physics, okay? So we're trading off 1F with 1 tau as our parameters in these two particular models, say. And we have to normalize these parameters with some observation or another, and we all get the right answer because we have this parameter we can wiggle. And unfortunately, at these scales, I don't think the subgrid physics is actually constraining in any way. So we need to worry about this at much smaller scales. Okay, so the first quasars, we heard a lot about this. What I'm going to try and look into is, okay, we have this very large volume. I'm now not picking it. I don't want to put any prior or where I think maybe black holes may be growing more or less. Let me just look in this giant volume and what are the objects that, for me, are actually getting the largest gas inflows into the center. Okay, so what we are after is to say, are there any object that can sustain ad interim like accretion, because that's the requirement for a sustained amount of time, for enough time to reproduce the right black hole masses. So that's what I did. I went into this giant volume, and I'm looking at redshift 6, which ones are my largest black holes after I let them accrete from the surrounding gas and so on. And I find some. I definitely find some that already at redshift 7 are approaching 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9. This is just one example that I picked to show. It's not just one. We can place these bright objects onto constraints for the luminosity functions. Some of the data is there. The lines are the luminosity functions as predicted from this particular large volume, okay, from the very high redshift down to the observed redshift. And we're finding roughly the right amount of objects and roughly the right luminosity given the constraints that we have. Of course, the constraining power will come really from observing a higher redshift and even lower luminosities, but as far as we go right now, we have the sample of Sloan quasar in this large volume. So what does these objects look like in terms of how have they grown to those masses? Indeed, they've assembled roughly 10 to the 9 solar mass black holes by sustaining ad interim accretion pretty much most of the time until, indeed, this feedback has actually quenched their growth at some point and they've gone under ad. But there is a very long sustained phase of accretion. These are the kind of environments that we see cosmologically around these objects. This is another case, right? Sort of similar. This is a very strong exponential growth and a very strong quenching just right after redshift 6. This is sort of the large scales structure of the gas, color-coded by temperature as well. So you see both the strong gas inflows coming out into the large scales, the effects of the feedback that starts heating the gas well beyond what's shown here as the Vera radius, all the way into the full phase of the quenching, where there are still episodes of accretions as some of the gas is still coming through the this very strong very strong inflows, streams of cold gas, but a lot of it has been heated and ejected out. Okay, so the general picture is that we do find a lot of objects that have very strong inflows into the very central regions. They are able to stay at this ad interim accretion. This is mostly due to the very high gas density that we find ourselves in, into this very high redshift. And this high gas density, the highest gas density, is concentrated in these cold streams. They are coming, streaming through pretty much the dynamical timescale all the way into the center of the galaxy, something that Johan already described a bit. So this is just another way of looking at it, just measuring the temperature of this gas as a function of the radius as it comes into, this is sort of the virial radius, it comes into the radius, or into the central region of the halos. It gets heated as it's very close to the black hole by black hole feedback. But as we move this gas out and we track the gas as actually being accreting onto the black hole, we see that this gas has been staying cold by entering the virial radius all the way into the region close to the black hole. So it is belonging to these large-scale streams of gas that are coming in, just much like this picture is showing us. So there are certainly mergers as well. in some of these objects. This is the black hole mass of the main progenitor. This has undergone one major merger. There are objects for which have undergone many minor mergers as well. Thanks. So there are various scenarios that we can see these black holes are growing. Obviously, one of the fundamental questions is, okay, I'm doing this at kiloparsec resolutions, or just about sub-kiloparsec resolution at this high redshift, just because I gain, because I'm doing things in comoving units, so it's sort of slightly sub-kiloparsec. But what happens to the gas inside this region? Okay, so here is the question: is really, do we have this kind of pictures as we zoom into these halos and we do this at much higher resolution? Are the streams being disrupted? Is the gas not actually getting to the black hole inside the scales that was not resolving before? So Yufeng and also Johan, I'll show in a second, are doing this, are extracting the halos that we found in these very large scale simulations, the ones that seem to be the most inducive of this fast growth, and they are repeating these simulations at very high resolution. So these are examples from some of the gadget runs, so we're done with the same technique. This is sort of our initial resolution. You sharpen it up, and you sharpen it up even more. You can start, this is already resolution that are few hundred parsecs. So you're starting to really get to an idea of the structure of the gas closer in. And the bottom line of this is that we don't see very strong new things happening, very strong effects in these higher resolution runs. So again, these are the major property, like black hole masses, the accretion rate onto the black hole, the star formation rate of this galaxies, and across these three different resolutions of these zooms, we just don't see very strong effects, perhaps more so in the star formation rates. We can also worry about what the feedback is doing in terms of what if we try lower feedback. We can worry about different formulation of SPH, try something that is a bit more popular now, and so on. And we don't see, basically, in these very large halos, hardly anything matters, to be honest, okay? So you just get the right picture. The point is that with SPH, you can only go down to some scales, and now Johan is getting his simulations to go to much smaller scales by using RAMSES. So we're going even further down in resolution, further down into the tens of parsec regions. And this is one example of a comparison between the black hole mass and the redshift. We're really just looking at this now. And we realized that we did some things that were a little different, like, in the RAMSES run, we started from a smaller seed and so on. But vaguely, even there, we don't get any dramatic difference, okay? So we are going across, asking ourselves what's happening inside a resolution region and trying to do higher resolution, as well as trying different techniques to also investigate if our numerics have anything to do. This is a very nice a couple of movie that Johan put together. So this is, again, similar to what he was showing, but this is this particular halo. This is the accretion of so the gas distribution in this halo, and that was the stellar distribution. Sorry, I thought this was going to rewind, but I don't think I'm going to. So we're seeing all these nice lumps of gas coming in, most of which correspond to halos or subhalos, more subhalos that are being accreted onto this galaxy. And we're seeing this disruption a little bit toward the end phase of the growth of these halos. So again, in the RAMSES run, this is the typical star formation rate, the strong Eddington accretion phase here is scale, so that we are seeing that is strongly quenched at some point as well. So the features are similar. There's a very fast growth phase that we keep seeing down to resolution of now 10 parsecs or so. So let me just now, in the little bit of time, go also to, sort of the some of the properties of these halos in terms of how do they compare to the observed sample of Sloan quasars in terms of, say, the star formation rates that we get. So we are, the simulations are shown by lines. These sort of some of the constraints on the star formation rates with the points on this plot. So we get to the bulk of those. Perhaps we don't reach the highest star formation rates that observations seem to imply, the kind of cold gas fractions that the observations seem to imply. What do we get in terms of the M black hole sigma plane for these very high redshift quasars? These are the tracks from the simulations. These are sort of some constraints from the observations. Our black holes are just shooting up vertically around here. Okay, so there's very little growth in sigma while the black hole is growing tremendously. So we find black holes that are heavy compared to their sigma, compared to their local values. And this is not, we don't see that any difference in the overall population. So now I'm plotting the whole, not just the quasar, the bright end of this, right? Those objects that make it into the Sloan sample, but the overall sample. I'm going to borrow a couple of minutes. Don't eject me. our quasars sit pretty much on what is expected. At this high ratio, the overall population implies a steeper M sigma relationship compared to the local one. So heavy black holes compared to their bulge at high redshift. And if I put tracks through these populations, I see that black holes that undergo mergers are then moving on to their sigma relationship. So they're not quite completely dry mergers, but sigma tends to grow as a consequence of very major merger, typically. So the black hole has already grown. Sometimes, soon after that, there's a major merger is going to shoot this black hole horizontally toward higher sigma values. So these are some examples. Just again, for the overall populations, if we say lambda is the Eddington fraction, and this is divided by 1 plus e cubed, okay, and we plot that as a function of black hole mass, we've seen that typically the highest accreting, the black holes that are growing the most, they're around a mass scale of about 10 to the 8. That's before feedback has a chance to actually have a lot of effect onto it and therefore quench the growth. So there's sort of a mass scale across all these redshifts where the black holes always like to grow, right? And that's before their feedback tends to have a strong effect. And that sort of corresponds to where the density toward the central region is always peaking at as we look also as a function of host mass. So this black hole accretion rate, this Eddington ratio, really track basically pretty much the density in the center as a major parameter in there. And this 1 plus e cubed is sort of shown here. So the Eddington fractions as a function of redshift grow significantly. The gas is just so much denser at high redshift, right? And there's just a very strong, the highest Eddington fraction, the highest growing black holes are going to be found out there. So there's nothing surprising, and that's what we get. Okay, I promise not much. I don't know what this. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so now let's look a little bit more at going down into redshift. So these are just pieces of these larger other massive black hole simulations. We're moving down to a regime where we can go to the lowest redshift. We can compare with also new observations that are coming along or new samples that are probing fainter populations. We're starting to see some issues, like our prediction here in magenta, shown in magenta, is a bit too steep compared to what we're seeing, okay? We are having perhaps too many black holes at the lower luminosity range, even a high redshift. When we go to luminosity functions now with a Boss quasar sample, we're seeing that as we move toward the lower redshift from redshift 3, again, the simulations are these black areas in these diagrams, we're starting to get problems. Maybe we're getting too steep. Maybe the IGN feedback is too effective at quenching our quasars at lower redshift. But it's not huge and something that is sort of we're looking into a bit more. In terms of clustering as well, our objects roughly live in the halos that we expect them to live when we compare them to the bright quasar population, like the Sloan quasar sample. So when we look at the cluster, the strength of clustering as a function of redshift, it's roughly what we would expect. And now we have this sample of black holes. We have a few hundred thousand black holes, which you're welcome to peek at. In the simulations, we have millions of galaxies. We can also look at predictions of from these models of the galaxy mass function and other properties of galaxies. This is a very high redshift. This is the galaxy stellar mass function in the simulations, which is, again, the line in here compared to some of the data, like Gonzalez et al. So this is not too bad, a high redshift. We definitely have a blue and red sequence in the simulations. These are the clouds of point under there. This is sort of a rough representation of the Baldry et al. Results. But one thing that I just, then I'll just really wrap up, I want to notice that in general, we find the AGN feedback is not sufficient to actually make the whole population of red galaxy. We don't have enough red galaxy, okay? So this is perhaps not consistent with some of the semi-analytical model. In the numerical simulations, at the end, statistically, we certainly have a red population, but it's not quite as significant as the one that is observed. Okay, this is another compilation of the spectral energy distribution, the cosmic spectral energy distribution from our simulations compared to the gamma results.
You're now 5 minutes over.
Okay, and again, sorry, and that is sort of consistent with the sort of cosmic spectral energy distribution. So this is the view. There's certainly some progress, and we are identifying areas where. Particularly in the low redshift regime, I think we are seeing more issues that we can tweak and learn a bit more on how to implement and learn about feedback in structural formation. We certainly see a high growth, a very sustained growth of quasars at very high redshift. That perhaps doesn't seem to be a problem at all in cosmic structure formation to get places that can undergo very significant growth at early time. And I really stop at that. Sorry.
Thank you. The talk was 6 minutes over in the end, and we will have a few questions, then we'll adjourn for a break, and you can ask more questions then.
If I understand correctly, then your initial resolution is a field of kiloparsecs, right?
Yes.
So you are growing black hole, which have like kind of scales of parsecs, or I mean, if we talk about the influence radius or something like this, and your simulations have scales of kiloparsecs, so from that scale to the black hole,
it's a black box. Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah.
So
yeah, that's what you're asking yourself. Suppose I take a modulated inflow rate, because I have to modulate it, at the scale that I see, as it has anything to do with the growth of my black hole at the center, and the answer is perhaps yes. Yeah. Because when we go to lower scale, we see that that relationship still holds, that, you know, the inflow rate that I get as an increasingly smaller scale are still related in a similar way to what I was getting. But I'm doing some subgrid physics to get an inflow rate. I'm not taking the whole mass flux at kiloparsec level to feed my black hole. But that's the hypothesis you start with, and you want to see where are the major inconsistencies in this. When I look at the overall population and not at the overall growth of my black hole population and not any interesting detailed physics in it, yeah. Do I get that overall right?
Two quick questions. One is, when you look at the color magnitude diagram of galaxies,
yes.
What redshift is that?
That's redshift zero.
Oh, that redshift zero.
Yeah. That's why we finally have, this is the actual polynomial that can be comparable to this. So we're testing a lot of stuff with other collaborators in terms of galaxy evolution models. Yeah. You definitely get this red sequence, but not enough of it.
Okay. The second one was just, that's not related to the simulation, but when you showed the matter power spectrum.
Yes.
And if I remember correctly, I saw that so it's like AGN feedback is transporting, so you know, it's just the transporting baryons from small
yes.
scale to large
yes,
scale.
That's correct. Yeah, so there's a dilution instead of a
change transfer of power. But
yes, so it's a decrement.
Yeah,
yes,
I saw that there was a megaparsec scale effect. So is it like, what was that model based on? Did they have a model or did they?
Yeah, it's very similar to the ones that presented here. That it's a Simboloni et al. They've used the OWL simulation to make predictions.
Oh, so they had like.
So it's very similar.
So they had like
actually coarser.
Scale,
yeah, yeah.
Megaparsec scale. Outflows.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's where
in the same exact sort of extremely similar to what I discussed here. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Tiziana, I was curious. So, obviously, if you look at the black holes that are the redshift 6 quasars, they have a real range in their accretion histories, how they arrive there.
Correct.
But
yeah.
it appears from the few that you showed
yeah.
that the assumption that a merger delivers a surge, a growth
yes.
surge. May not really work, or is it just that we saw very few that there?
Yeah, so I showed a few.
Population.
So a merger is not required to deliver this fast strong inflows. Of course, there are mergers there, and some of them are major mergers, but it's not a requirement at all. We have very isolated objects that are. Undergo, you know, they're getting all this gas from these cold streams, and there's lots of minor merging at you know, subhalos coming through these cold streams, but not major mergers. So it's not a strong requirement.
The environment
depends yes,
on
yes.
That
yeah, yeah. So perhaps it is true that the ones that indeed are environments which undergo major mergers are the most extremes. The highest densities, but also will achieve the highest luminosities, the highest inflow rates, but not by a significant amount, but they're sort of on the extreme.
Yeah. Lucio. Tiziana, at the beginning you mentioned that you think that all the accretion rate recipes and large scales give you the same answer.
I was a bit provocative.
But the big question is whether they're all giving you a wrong answer of that scale.
Yes, yeah, very true, yeah.
The problem, it's relevant to one of the things that you showed, that you had this very fast growth of the black holes, up to 10 to the 8 solar masses. So I wonder whether that's sort of related to the fact that the accretion rate, the real accretion rate would be lower than the feeding rate, because what we, in the simulations, we always look at the feeding rate in the end. Not the real accretion rate of the black hole.
Yeah. So my view that is, and that perhaps I'm sort of inclined to buy De Boer and Hopkins, and meaning that that's what I'm seeing as well. That you can fiddle your accretion rate models or accretion flow, but at the end it's really feedback that is the heart of the game. Okay, so that's what really regulates at the end the accretion rate, the final. Inflow rate onto my black hole. So you can do a lot of variations in your accretion prescription, but they're never going to be as sensitive. Your final answer is never going to be as sensitive as you change the feedback. So I'm more at these scales, I'm more worried about us getting the feedback right, almost. Although that's certainly a good point that we have to bear in mind, that the inflow rate onto the black hole. But this is sort of part of the hypothesis you're making, right? When you play this game, you say, okay, suppose this, I had this inflow rate at large scales. If I start getting everything screwed up, it means that that can't be used, right, as a proxy for anything that happens at smaller scales. And for now, I think all of us, we're not seeing a really strong problem with that, right, that points us to say, okay, we're all wrong. We're never going to learn about the overall growth of black holes. Right now, we're not at that state. I'm looking for that, you know, if anybody finds them. Okay.
Sure. Okay. So from the picture you showed about the temperature of the gas within in the vicinity, within your kiloparsec scale resolution, for these high redshift quasars, the temperature seemed to be very high. This is what you were saying.
Close in.
And
But
there are observations of CO, for instance, that shows that the gas actually is very cold, rather cold. So the gas, the luminosity of the CO seems to suggest that you have a big reservoir of cold gas extending up to 2.5 kiloparsec, roughly, in these high redshift quasars. I don't know if you can comment on that or if...
Yeah, so I'll try to be brief. What I was plotting is sort of this average temperature of the gas. There is definitely a cold phase, particularly in the strong, during the period of strong growth. Most of the gas that is being accreted is cold gas, and most of it would be in this molecular phase, although we don't follow it directly. But we definitely see there's a lot of cold gas coming in. Even in Johan's movie, you could see this blob of cold gas coming in being swallowed. Okay. When I'm doing this plot, I'm looking at an average temperature, and because feedback has heated a lot of the gas, then everything is sort of pushed up. There is definitely a cold phase, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm interested in AGN feedback in low-mass galaxies, because the standard picture is that low-mass makes some feedback, but in AGN feedback goes a long way in the low-mass system. So in your work, do you allow for AGN feedback in low-mass systems? Or is it shut off somehow in the prescription? And if not, what do you find in terms of the feedback?
I was rushing through this a little bit. So, for instance, from the galaxy stellar mass function, we allow feedback at all scales. That's how partially you get the M sigma, which is growth on. We find that any feedback, at least in this kind of scales or this kind of resolution, is insufficient to actually do much into small galaxies. They are too bright. So even with AGN feedback, our galaxies have produced too many stars, and they're a bit too bright.
Okay, so there is neither stellar feedback nor AGN.
But caveat, these scales are not ideal. Okay, the more we go towards smaller mass scales of galaxies, the more we're going to be, this is going to get tricky because the resolution is not going to be very good to tackle that. And then more the zoom simulation are going to be important to decide this.
Thanks.
In your subgrid physics, you have a few parameters that you calibrated, right? And then you present these consistency checks. Which of those would you describe as a happy surprise or is not?
Okay, so the parameter I have that I calibrate is the sigma relationship at redshift zero. So from previous run, we fixed the amount that we couple to the surrounding. But this fixed the normalization, not the shape. So the shape of the M sigma is a good information. And in general, the luminosity functions of quasars don't look too bad. But with the new data, we are starting to see some regions where things are OK. Nice surprises are also the galaxy stellar mass functions. They look good. So we are not getting the completely wrong, the right black holes in completely the wrong galaxy. And I haven't elaborated too much, and there's a lot of stuff to analyze. But. Oh, sorry, thanks. And clustering is a good thing here. We're not imposing which objects are accreting at which rate. Suddenly we measure clustering for the observed populations. It looks like we're getting the right statistics there, so the right objects. The right halos are undergoing the right level of activity in terms of black holes.
Okay, before we thank the speakers, I want to remind you we will reconvene at 3:30 for the contributed talks. Thanks.